Now we turn to a workshop by Fred Craddock. In the two previous editions of Preaching Today, we have presented parts 1 and 2 of Dr. Craddock's workshop on using stories in the sermon. Now we turn to the final workshop in our series. Dr. Craddock is professor of preaching and New Testament at Candler School of Theology at Emory University in Atlanta. We now present part 3 of Preaching as Storytelling.
Have you had the experience of telling a story in a sermon, and then later when you're preparing your sermon, you say, I wish I'd have saved that story? We must be careful about that, because most of the power of a story is not somebody's particular ability to tell a story. Most of the power in a story is in its appropriateness. If anything can be said about the Word of God, it is appropriate. There's no such thing as an inappropriate Word of God. Therefore, the fittingness of it is extremely important. So we start with the text. We select stories which by their nature have size and quality and dimension. Not little simplified bumper sticker cute things, but big things. And then, to move among them with the magnet of the text to be appropriate. Appropriate not just to the text, but appropriate to the listener, and appropriate to the experience to be created, the message to be delivered. Now, this appropriateness applies not just to the selection of stories for the sermon, but the location of the stories within the sermon. Now, that is difficult, and many of us have regrets. Immediately after preaching, I told that story too soon. I told that story too late. Have you noticed sometimes you'll hear a story that to you is very moving or very good or very funny, and you go to tell it to someone else, and you say, it lost something in translation, or I'm not a very good storyteller, or, you just had to be there. The difference is not that you are not as good a storyteller. It's just that you've taken the egg out of the nest and just laid it out on a limb. And it's a different story, you see? What makes the story powerful is the taking of time to build the context in which it is told. And then placing it. Many, many marvelous things are said too soon in a sermon. The people have to be given time to get on the bus before you go roaring off. You notice our preacher this week at night just starts off in a kind of meandering. He didn't have to get in a hurry. He didn't have to unload just, a couple of buckets of jewels on us. The way I was taught homiletics is you give a lot of rich stuff right at the beginning to tantalize the imagination and capture the interest and kindle their thought and all like that. I don't think so. If the people know that you are going somewhere, they'll get on the bus. And therefore, one prepares for it. Even in telling stories to our children, when our children were small and I would make up stories to tell them at night. Because I got tired of reading those. And you couldn't skip a page, you know how it is? And you're sleepy and tired, and you've been through this story every night about the 9 friendly dogs, and you think the kid's about half asleep, and you turn 4 or 5 pages. You skip some, Daddy, So I started making up stories. But you have to prepare. You touch the child, fix the covers, comfortable. Did you have a nice day? What'd you enjoy doing today? And this and that. And did I ever tell you about the time when I was your age and so on? You prepare for it. But a lot of our preaching is like going into the child and saying, well, I don't have time for the whole story, but I want to give you basically the gist of it. And that's no good. It's not just the point, it's the experience of it. And that takes some preparation. I would suggest that one be very careful in the preparation of an introduction, that the introduction be, for most of us, some of us have skills otherwise, but for most of us, to prepare it last. Logically, that's true. How can you prepare an introduction to what you don't have? You prepare the sermon and then prepare the introduction. And by that way, you will not unload your strong material and stories that need contexting too soon. Because if any of us have regrets about the location of material in the sermon, it is usually we gave it too soon. If that story had been told at the end of that sermon, it would have been extremely powerful. As it was, you wasted it just sort of getting people interested. Now, this applies, may I say, if I can drop a footnote here, this applies also in the location of a text in preaching. People have habitually thought that you read the text and go from there. Read the text and start preaching. Why? Sometimes that's just not appropriate. Did you know you could spend about 20 minutes dealing with some matters and getting them ready and then say, and now let's hear the text. And people will go away saying, you know, I never really heard that text before. Location, appropriateness is extremely important for this matter. It is important also in telling stories to remember that the key to the power of the story lies very much in its movement. Forget structure. Just the movement of it. Movement of it. Stories move. Stories are to be heard, not seen. In fact, that is usually my best counsel to anyone about a sermon. Forget about getting an outline. Get the movement. Get the movement. How does it unroll? How does it move? But especially a story. Masterful storytellers do it that way. That timing. You know, I mentioned the storyteller. Good storyteller is reluctant. One reason they're reluctant is they have to pick the time and the occasion. You don't just walk up to them and say, hey, I understand you tell good stories. Tell me one. No. They have to build the occasion and build the time and build the way and be ready for it. And usually, there's a lot of hesitation. As some of you know, my father was an excellent storyteller, my mother too, but my father created stories, and he built in certain methods of delaying and timing it. He would come in the evening. We lived in a farmhouse. The only heat we had in the winter was the fireplace. Oh, there was a wood stove in the kitchen. We had a fireplace, and he would put an old porcelain coffee pot down in the coals. He would warm himself, and with his back to us, we'd be sitting there supposed to be doing our arithmetic or something. And he, talking to himself, would say, whoosh, I hope I never see again what I saw today. Huh. And that's all he would say. And we were always a little bit afraid of him. We'd ask my oldest brother, Waller, we'd say, ask him what he saw. And Walter would say, well, Daddy, what did you see today? He said, oh, you kids still up? I thought that was your mother. Oh, well, never mind. You know, we can't stand it. We can't stand it. And finally, we'd say, well, what was it? You can just tell us part of it. What was it? Oh, well, I suppose. And then he would start telling a story. And he'd get to a certain point, and then he smoked golden grain, roll your own cigarettes. It took him 13 hours. And then roll up some paper and stick in the fire and get a fire and get that lit and get a draw. Here we are. And that timing. Now, it was a part of his method, but he had to create the situation to move to it. Now, the movement of it. Picture an old man peeling an apple for his grandson. Grandpa, will you peel this apple for me? Mama thinks I might get choked some on the peeling. Okay. And he pulls out an old Barlow that he uses for everything. Opens it up. Rubs it on his bridges. After all, it's his grandson. He doesn't want any germs. And he starts peeling. Now he just starts peeling. Just starts peeling. Real slow. And the curl begins to drop. And he says, you know, one time I peeled 35 of these before I ever broke a peel. Now what's happening to the kid? The juices are flowing. See? The stomach is saying, I thought I was going to get an apple. The saliva is flowing. The body is getting ready for the apple. Getting ready for the apple. And he just keeps going. When is he going to get through? Finally, the peel drops at his feet. I made it. And the kid starts to lunge. Wait just a minute. And then he lays it out. Let me get the core out for you. And just take it forever. Now, when the kid gets the apple, it is the best apple in the world. Now, contrast that to walking up to a machine, putting in a quarter, pulling a lever, grabbing an apple and eating it on the way to something. When the stomach is saying, I didn't ask for an apple. Now, think of those two scenes on the movement of your preaching. Do the people get prepared to come to the conclusion when you come to the conclusion? It's not all that difficult. It's just a matter of saying, I respect the listener, and I trust the listener, and I want them to take this trip with me. And when you get there, you all get there, and it's a delight. Now, where do we get stories? Well, we get stories wherever they are, and they are mostly in observation and experience. In observation. The stories of life, real good stories of things that happen, are as available to you as to me, to anyone. Just that some of us have, by negative adaptation, lost our capacity to pick up on the sights and sounds of our world, or if we notice it, we don't make any notes to ourselves, we don't preserve any records, and therefore it's lost. And then we sit around in our studies later saying, now what was that? Let's see, what was it? We were coming back from Little Rock, and what was it now? What was that? Well, I don't know, you know. If you do make notes to yourself now, be sure to write enough that you can recover it later. If you just enter something brief, well, I'll remember it. Bird sitting on limb. Later on, you look at that bird on limb, what's bird on limb? And it's gone. I personally, it may not be advisable for everybody, but I not only keep notes of things I observe and all like that because I don't trust my memory and they're too important to waste, but I also keep a journal that at the close of the day, I just enter the way I feel about the experiences. It's not a diary. George came by at 9 this morning. It's not a diary. It's what happened today, the way I reflect on the day. And in that context, things that I've heard or seen, I can recover the experience of them, not just the information of them. Observation, just listening to things, watching children, watching each other, sitting in restaurants, everywhere these are. Kind of a sad day, funny thing happened once. I don't get to go to New York very often, and I'd spent my money on the room and was in a little old place getting a hot dog. And there were only two customers. There were two others besides myself. It's an elderly woman waiting on us. She was in her 70s. Her name was Anna. There was an old man in a booth. He wasn't being waited on. I could just see the top of his head. I knew he was an old man. Later, I heard his voice. And so I was just listening, and suddenly conversation started between the old man and Anna. I don't know his name. She never called him by name. He said to her, the boss wants me to stick around in case you get busy. I can help you. She says, who's busy? Three people. He says, well, you may get busy. I won't get busy. He said, well, just in case. She said, okay, if you want to stick around. He said, and then when you close, I can walk you home. She said, ha-ha, now I know why you're staying, she said. He said, well, I'll just walk you home. She said, you'll not walk me home. She's, I would say, 75 years old. You'll not walk me home? He said, I will walk you home, too. You need somebody to walk you home? Yeah, you want to walk me home. Pretty soon you walk me home, and I will be great with child. I mean, I've left my hot dog by now. And he said to her, what are you talking about, Anna? You passed that 40 years ago. She said, huh? You don't know about Sarah? He said, Sarah who? She said, Sarah in the Bible. Sarah in the Bible was older than I, and she was great with child. And he said, well, how did she do that? Anna said, she believed in the man upstairs. And she said, and something else, the mother of our Lord, before she was ever married, before she ever knew a man, was great with child. And he said, how did she do that? And she said, she believed in the man upstairs. And this old man said, well, if I were a woman, I wouldn't believe in the man upstairs. Thank you. commentary that'll give that to you. Your own experiences, especially if you have that sense of freedom, if you feel secure enough to be able to laugh at the things you do wrong, the mistakes you make, in the pulpit, out of the pulpit, things that happen to you that at the time you may flinch, later you laugh about. If you have that sense of freedom that gives you a sense of humor, that's what sense of humor is. A sense of humor is the clearest evidence that I know of the grace of God at work in a person's life, because they no longer have to try to be God's detective. God takes care of his business, and he gets along well without me. He was working it before I came. He has given me the privilege to share in it, but it'll keep going after I'm gone. It's not to be non-serious. It's simply to be free, to accept one's place in the grace of God. And if you have that freedom to think about yourself and your own experiences, that will be a grand source. The question comes, well, should I tell things about myself in the pulpit? The standard, the canon by which you measure whether or not a personal story is to be used, is whether or not the personal story is not just yours, but is every person's. To what extent in that experience you were every person. You were Adam and Eve. And if you were every person, so that the listeners can identify with it, it can be told. If it was yours in a peculiar sense, remote from the experiences of other people, it's for private conversation and not for the pulpit, because there can be no identification. And the point of it all is for people to enter into the story. Create stories. In the creation of stories, one gives clues to the listeners that the story was created. Now, the clues to the listeners that I've made up the story consist in a number of things. It's total absurdity, like a 9-pound sparrow. Or the way you started. Once upon a time, the way Jesus usually started them was with two statements. One, which of you? You knew it was a parable. Or, there was a certain man, and you knew it was a parable. Now, I'm sure there were people who came up later and said, Jesus, did that really happen? Well, I don't know whether they did or not. They were accustomed to parables, accustomed to stories. But little clues that don't detract from the power of the story should be given to release people from engaging in the thing in the wrong way. But create stories. Now, we can all do it. The best way to do it is start with children when you're not embarrassed to tell stories and make up stories. And I would suggest that you tell stories when you haven't completed one. Start telling one you don't even know how it's going to end. And under the pressure of finding an ending to that story, you'll create some very good stuff. I mean, that's the way you got through college and seminary. So, just do it that way. I have myself started stories when the kids were small. I would start stories. The Indian who hunted with the crooked arrow. I started that story. I didn't know how it was going to go, but the pressure of having to bring it to some conclusion, and things came to mind. I suggest groups do it. Family groups. It was always the habit of us when the family was all together, the evening meal together, and we had a little ritual. We'd go around the table. What is the worst thing that happened to you today? And I would say, John, Laura, Nettie, all of us would say, you know the worst thing that happened today? Of course, John usually said the same thing. School bell rang at 8:30. And then we'd get around to, what was the best thing that happened today? And he said, it rang again at 3:30. Well, but we would usually just spill our gripes, and then what really good happened today? And then we would start taking it that, you know, and stories would develop. Games like that. You can do it in church groups. When I teach the parables, whether in the church or in the seminary, we don't start by studying the parables of Jesus. We start with a parable. What is a parable? And we start creating parables. And the way you create parables is to set up a condition. And then tell somebody, well, now finish that. Just finish that. Not too long ago, in a certain setting, I started a parable with a group of church folk. It was in Amarillo, Texas. And I said, well, now let's just create a parable. I said, there was a certain man, very, very stingy. The young people, not knowing him very well, who were in his church ask him, as Christmas approached, if he would play Santa Claus in their program. In a moment of thoughtlessness and carelessness, he said he would. As the time approached, he got nervous about it, and the evening before the program, he said to his family, "Why in the world they asked me? They know I don't go for all this, giving away stuff and Santa Claus and all like that. I don't go for this. Why did they ask me?" And all that, he fussed around. And then he got serious. He said to the family, "I hope you'll be thinking of me and pray for me that I'll do a good job." And the family said, "We will. And you will." And so he went to the church with a suit on, and it came to pass. And I laughed at it then. That was in the evening. Next morning after breakfast, we got together, and I said, "Okay, how did the story end?" We had some delightful stuff. People came up and said, "I couldn't go to sleep till I finished that thing." One fellow stood up and said, "And it came to pass that he went to the church, and in the role of Santa Claus, he gave away all his wealth. And his family had him committed." There was a certain small town that had one church, and the church building burned, and the pastor put a notice in the weekly paper, "Is there some other group in town that would allow us to use their facilities until we can rebuild? We need a place to hold our Sunday service." There was no response except from the funeral home. They accepted the invitation and began to hold their services in the funeral home. And it came to pass. Now that's the assignment on the way home. Next time I see you, you can tell me how that ended. Make-up stories. It's a delightful thing. It's a good experience. And one thing, it was the way, may I hate all to just keep referring to the family this way, but this is one of the ways we taught Bible to our children. It's instead of just Bible verses and memorizing like I did, which is not all that bad. I'd like to find somebody who knows a little Bible today. But sometimes I would tell a story and then say to the children, "Does that remind you of anything in the Bible?" And their mind would go searching around like an antenna, you know, trying to find, "Well, is that sort of like, or isn't that like, or isn't that like?" And it was doing a lot of things. It was tying life and scripture together. It was an educational experience. They're all kind of, well, you've already been thinking of a number of other ways that you're doing it or will do it, so I'll not tarry there anymore. The telling itself, the telling of the story itself. May I make just a few suggestions? An economy of words. Economy of words, not too many adjectives. Leave something for the listener to contribute. If you over-describe something, it's insulting. Just think of that marvelous story to which I've referred several times, the story of the prodigal son. Ring, robe, shoes, fatted calf. And you see the whole thing. You can describe a football game. Men in striped shirts, the uniforms, the cheerleaders, the raising of the flag, the national anthem, and everybody is at the game. But if you just go on and on and on, it's insulting because we've been to a ball game, we know. So just an economy of words. A reason for economy of words is not just that I've mentioned, but also it's a way of avoiding dictating to your listener the conclusion they're to reach about it. If I throw in too many adjectives, I'm telling you how to feel and how to think about what I'm saying. I know this man, neighbor of mine, who is such a marvelous, marvelous, sincere, genuine, one of the most sincere and conscientious, dedicated and committed Christian men I know. Okay, I'm about to tell a story about him, but I have already told you the way you're to feel about him and think about him before I've told the story. Now, wipe all that out. Just say, "I know this fellow lives near me, and I tell the story," and you're sitting there thinking, "Now there's a Christian." But I haven't given you room to think it because I've already told you to think that. We don't want to oppress and spiritually violate our listeners by drawing their conclusions for them. Use images. People's minds are like galleries of pictures. This is where prejudices are lodged. Misinformation is lodged. Hatreds are lodged. Old grudges are lodged in pictures. And you mention something, and they have a picture of that in their mind. And the only way that's going to be changed, and they're going to grow and become more Christian, is to replace those pictures with other pictures. Therefore, we need pictures, images. Can we see it? Can we see it when it's told? And that's very important, because people have their own images, and you want to change those images. As I try to discuss in that little book, Is One Without Authority, we don't want to get lost in all those long words that end in I-T-Y, and S-H-I-P, and N-E-S-S. Righteousness, stewardship, responsibility, fellowship, and all those words. We have to use them some. But can it be tasted? Can I taste it, smell it, see it, feel it? Is it something very specific? You don't go out to a farmer and say, I'd like to discuss calfdom. You don't say to a carpenter, well, essentially the chairness of that. No, it's just chair and calf. There is no such thing as holy matrimony. Holy matrimony is the distant summation of all the weddings. And if you describe a single wedding and picture a father gotten out of the closet a suit and that whole scene, and you start describing that wedding, every wedding in the house will be remembered, and one man in tears back there will notice he still has some rice in the cuff and he remembers his daughter. But you're talking about holy matrimony. And nobody twitches at all. That's the way it is. Mortality. We're all mortal. Well, of course. You put that to a vote, it'll pass. We're all mortal. But if you get up and say, we have just received word that Mrs. Thomas' son, Charles, was killed delivering papers this morning. The church becomes the church. What can we do? What's the difference? Mortality? Nothing. It is important in storytelling also to use direct discourse rather than indirect. That is, to actually use quotes, to recreate conversation rather than just describing it. Notice all the stories of Jesus. And the master said, well done, good. And I was afraid. And so I buried him in the ground. Take him hand and foot. Here you have given me 5 talents. I have made it 5. And the father said, son, you are always with me. And he said, Father, I have sinned against heaven. Oh, bring the robe. Notice conversation, 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 conversation all the time. Don't stretch it out and make it descriptive. Reproduce the conversation. It's the way to become interior to the material. Also, it is important to allow people to identify with characters in the story, not to tell them to identify. It is a deadly sign that you haven't done a good job of telling the story, biblical or otherwise, if you have to reach a point and say, now, let's identify with that person. This is the way it usually goes. There is a story, you're unrolling some material, and then you pause and say, now, aren't we very much like Simon Peter? Aren't we today very much like the Pharisee? That's bad. I've tried to think of another way to say it. That's just bad. The reason it's bad is that you've been too dependent on the hortatory. Preaching that, we call it application. Of course you want application. But the application comes bleeding through if you've done a good job. You can talk about Simon Peter in such a way that I'm sitting back there and I am convicted because you've held up a mirror to me. But you don't hold up a mirror to me and say, don't you look like what you see in that mirror? Let me identify, don't tell me I identify with. You see? That's a kind of a crutch. I don't want to do that. The Pharisees can be described in such a way that I squirm, I squirm, I squirm. Now, I know our time is up, but let me just mention an exercise. It's for the students, but that's rehearsal, but it might be all right for you to do. I think it would be helpful. In order to be sure that we're in touch and appropriate to the people, in touch with where they are and who they are, I suggest an exercise to the students of just once or twice a week, take a sheet of paper and say, what's it like to be? And then put something in the middle of that page and write around it everything that comes to mind. Spend just 5 or 10 minutes, once or twice a week, and it will give flavor and pulse and feeling and power to everything you tell, scripture and otherwise. What's it like to be 14? What's it like to be 14? And if you'll spend 10 minutes with that, sympathetically, empathetically, with imagination, with recollection, the next time you preach, you won't be saying, the trouble with young people today, because you have thought about what's it like to be 14. What's it like to be fired? Just nothing else now, just that. What's it like to be alone? Alone. One of the students some time ago asked me to go out and preach for him. He was away on working for the kingdom. I think he was skiing in Colorado. And wanted me to fill in. I went out. I like to go out to the churches and preach. Small, large, whatever. Church is church. And I like to go. And I went for him. And after the service, an elderly woman came up to me and said, you want to have lunch with me? I said, be glad to. This is a small village, no restaurant there. I went with her. We went to this house, big frame house. For once, I'm sure, a lot of laughter and playing. And I saw the pictures on the piano, an old upright piano. And I knew she had children and grandchildren everywhere. But she was alone in this big house now. She said later, the home place. You go in there and read the paper or watch TV. I'll be ready in a minute. And she put on an apron. And I went in there. And she went off to some distant place in the house. And I could hear her in there just a-working. I thought, well, maybe I can help. And I went in, and she was in a formal dining room. And she was pulling out a big drawer of this chest thing off the side. I don't know the name of those things, but she got out a linen cloth, had creases in it 2 inches deep. I bet it hadn't been used in years. And she put that on the table, big, long table, big dining room. I said, we eat in the kitchen at home. And she went right on. She pulled out napkins, cloth napkins, and put them in little silver rings. You remember cloth napkins? I said, we eat in the kitchen at home. She went right on doing that, and she opened this thing with a curved glass front and pulled out some stemmed glasses and some old china with roses on it, put it out there. I said, well, we just eat in the kitchen at home. I said, oh. And she said, will you shut up and sit down? And I said, well, that was the next thing on my list. And so I went in. But before I went into the other room, she said to me, and she looked straight at me and said, Mr. Craddock, do you know what it's like day after day to fix a meal for one? And I said, no, ma'am, I don't. So, in a little while, we all gathered, she and I, around that table. And she assured me that the attendance that day was twice what it had been in months. And we had a banquet. Now, that experience was a gift to me. Just like we're gifts to each other. I do hope, if you haven't done it yet, you'll give somebody a story before you leave. Thank you.